Welcome into Buccaneers Insider Live, presented by Miller Lite. Casey Phillips and Scott Smith here. We're going to be getting to your Twitter questions later in the show. You can continue to send those in throughout this show. Use that hashtag BucksLive. We have a lot to get to. We haven't had a show since, you know, that little thing called the Super Bowl, that minor detail that happened. So we wanted to talk about that a little bit and the unfortunate news about John Lynch's Hall of Fame, which we kind of don't want to talk about, but want to at least
address what
happened on that. So any NFL news, league-wide, anything happening with the Bucs, any of those things that you have questions on, go ahead and send them our way. Draft things, free agency to a degree. Can't talk about that a whole lot yet when there aren't technically free agents yet. But let's go ahead and start with just your thoughts on the Super Bowl and what, if anything, you saw that especially would be applicable to Bucs fans, just thinking about what this says about the league, about the Super Bowl and the NFL and the direction it's going.
Two things stand out to me. One of them a lot of people are talking about, so it's not necessarily unique thought, but the aggressive play calling by Doug Peterson and the Eagles, especially on fourth down, short fourth downs, going for it, and they ended up being key plays. And the thing about it is that was staying in character for the Eagles, who'd been doing that all year. They made more fourth down conversions than any other team and went for it more than just about any other team during the season. It was a big part of their approach. And you've seen a lot of stories. Even there was actually one on ESPN before the Super Bowl, which was kind of prescient, and it was about all that and how all that stems from their analytics work throughout the season and even before the season. And the thing is, believe me, every team does that. It's worthy. The Eagles are worthy of getting attention for it because what they did was they committed to it. If your analytics are going to show that on average you're better off going for it on fourth and down at certain fourth down short and certain parts of the field, it doesn't really help you much if you only use it selectively. If going for it on fourth and one at the goal line averages, you know, if you do that every time you average 5 points rather than kicking a field goal, which it almost always makes, would be 3 points, you're really not going to see that benefit unless you really commit to it like the Eagles did, and they stuck to it. And I think I'm not necessarily applying that directly to Dirk or our play calling or anything, but I just think it's a good lesson for play callers all around the league. You know, if there's a reason, there's long been this analytics out there that suggests that this is a good approach, but it's hard for a team to completely sell out and go for it. But it worked for the Eagles.
Yeah, that's true. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on what an offensive game it was in general. I mean, I don't think anyone would have bet on the idea of there being, 1,100-plus yards in the Super Bowl. That just everything about it was insane. So what do you feel like that said about either those teams or the Super Bowl or just the league in general?
That goes right to my second point. And I don't know about you, but I was at a friend's house, you know, Super Bowl party. It was the third quarter, and the yards were piling up. And I said something like, man, this game's going to end up with, 850 or 900 yards. And then they put the stats up, and they were already there. It was already, 850
it's
yards.
Ridiculous.
This is early in the second half. I think what it shows, some of it is obviously a credit to the Eagles and the Patriots and Tom Brady and how well Nick Foles played and the play calling and so on. But there was one sack in that game. It was the key play to the game, but there was one sack. And you can give the quarterbacks credit for moving around, but that's what's going to happen. And we saw that this year, the Buccaneers. You know, that's what's going to happen if you can't get to the quarterback. There were games where good quarterbacks, you know, not so good quarterbacks, were able to put up a lot of yards against us just because you have to affect the quarterback.
That's so true. And we saw the one time the Eagles really did that.
It won the game for them.
Yep. It's even when it hit, to me, this was the point that was so interesting is, in a game that had as many points as it did, as many yards as it did, it was a defensive play that sealed the game.
Yeah, because it was the only one.
Right.
There was a fluky interception for the Patriots at one point. But otherwise, can you think of another really big defensive play in that game? So when you got two teams that essentially can't be stopped, there was one punt in the game.
Right.
The two teams that can't, two offenses that can't be stopped, it was the one big defensive play that won the game.
Which, by the way,
because it made the difference between those two.
Yeah, that's true. And I was talking to someone here and how we were laughing that how unfortunate for the punter that didn't get to punt. He didn't technically get to play in the Super Bowl.
He probably was the holder.
At least he got it. We were just talking about how sad that would be that you're technically a starter in that way of you're the punter.
Yeah.
And you're going to the Super Bowl and it's inevitable that you're going to get in and you don't.
Yeah. He probably didn't. He probably would have liked to have punted a few times, even if it means his team was less.
Right. Exactly.
Effective.
As long as it means that they ended up winning, I'm sure he'd be willing to sacrifice those punts.
I don't know. We had a punter. We had a game in Atlanta many years ago in the 90s, and we had a punter named Dan Straczynski, and we had a game where the offense did great and he didn't have to punt the entire game. And I saw him in the locker room the next day or later, and I said, hey, some joke about how you had an easy day or whatever. Yeah. He didn't find it funny at all.
He was mad at you. He didn't like the joke. That's an interesting point that it's like the one position that if you're doing your job, your team isn't.
Right.
And like the confusion on that of like rooting for your team to do well, but then you don't get to do anything.
You know, now that I think about it, if he was the holder, there were a lot of kicking miscues in that game too.
Oh.
Weren't there? There was one that was missed.
That's why he's a little upset.
I don't know if it was him or not. And so was the Patriots punter who never punted.
Yeah.
So I think there was a miss.
That's so interesting.
Let's just get off that subject.
All right. So looking at John Lynch and the Hall of Fame, not exactly transitioning to a subject that is even more exciting to talk about, but what I think that we're biased for clear reasons, but I don't think that we're biased in a way that makes us blind to what he actually did. And it probably makes us more capable of seeing what he did for the Buccaneers and for the league, even in that position. Mm-hmm. What is it that you think we see that everybody else doesn't see that
I wonder if the very good direction that the league has gone in attempts to make the game safer have led current voters to put less value in this thing about John being such a feared hitter, you know, because... Right. That part of the game has been lessened for good reason, and John was not a headhunter or a guy who was injuring players. He just was a very hard tackler. He was a good hard tackler, a sound tackler, who's told me before when we've talked about it that he thinks he could easily play just as well under the current rules. But I wonder if that whole thought process sort of devalues that bit of his game, because that's a big part of it. I mean,
the NFL
films called him the 10th most feared tackler of all time, you know? That's an important thing because we have quotes from guys like Barry Sanders and Marshall Faulk saying just him being out there made you think about his presence and made you had to be aware of him. Right. That, to me, that's making an impact on the game. Mm-hmm. And when you have guys like Bob Sanders and others saying, John Lynch was the player I was trying to be, doesn't that mean you set a standard and you changed the game? I think so. The other thing, again, is it's always going to be there, is that John Lynch's interception totals. When you talk about a defensive back, most of the defensive backs, corners or safeties in the Hall of Fame have a lot of interceptions, more so than John. But look at this real quick, and then we can get off this because it's an unhappy topic.
Yes.
But Brian Dawkins, who made it this year, and should. He was great. He should be in the Hall of Fame, and so should a few more safeties, had 37 career interceptions. John Lynch had 26. Yeah, that's a difference. That's notable. But also look at the fact that of John Lynch's 26 interceptions, 21 came in wins, 14 came in the fourth quarter, and 11 of those 14 in the fourth quarter were when the Bucs were either up or down by 7 or fewer points. Those were key plays. And we remember that anecdotally. He was called the closer for a reason. We remember anecdotally that he made those plays, but your average voter isn't going to remember that, isn't going to know that. But if you look at the numbers, he had more of those type of fourth quarter close game interceptions than Dawkins did. He had 3. Lynch had 11. Lynch may not have the over-the-top interception totals, but when you consider how important his takeaways were and you add it to, you know, he's a champion, he was a huge, important part of that defense that was one of the greatest defenses of all time, add it all together, and he's a Hall of Famer. But it's apparently the voters are not agreeing.
Which is unfortunate. And now, what are you thinking about the odds moving forward? I think that we thought this year was one of his better shots at it based on who was up. And are you thinking that it might be a little bit harder road now?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. You can say they were trying to clear out, like they did with receivers a few years ago. They sort of cleared out the logjam. They had Andre Reed, and they had Tim Brown, and they had Chris Carter. And one at a time, they got through them. So you could look at it, okay, they put Brian Dawkins in, but they didn't want to do two safeties this year. They didn't want two out of the five spots to go to that position. Maybe if you could say that, they're clearing the space for John Lynch next year. They focused on Dawkins this year and don't do Lynch. That's a possibility.
Right.
On the flip side, Ed Reed is about to hit the ballot, and that's not going to help anybody because Ed Reed is clearly a Hall of Famer. So, you know, somewhere along the line, Troy Polamalu is going to be on the ballot. So it's not going to get any easier. But there have been guys like a Charles Haley who've waited 5, 6. Some of them, I think Andre Reed waited 8 years. There's no reason to give up hope. It's just a little bit demoralizing right now.
Yep, that's very true. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to get back with some other league news, things that are coming up on the Bucs schedule. And, of course, your Twitter questions, you can keep sending those to us. Use that hashtag BucsLive, and we'll be back in a bit.
Hey, hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs know how to shine. Hey, hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs know how to shine. Give a cheer for the Buccaneers. Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Hey, hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs know how to shine.
Hey, hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs know how to shine. Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Go Bucs!
Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Stand up.
Give a cheer for the Buccaneers.
Go Bucs! because we know we're on the top.
We stand up!
Welcome back to Buccaneers Insider Live, presented by Miller Lite. Casey Phillips and Scott Smith here. We're going to get to a couple of your Twitter questions coming up here. Use that hashtag BucksLive. We're going to get to also a couple of our last topics we wanted to discuss. Coaching changes around the league. Interesting development even recently on that front. Just wanted to see your thoughts on what some of those moves say about the league, and if any of them might affect the Bucks in terms of teams we do or don't play moving forward, and just some of the different directions that means certain teams are going.
Well, we were counting it down earlier, and we realized we're not playing any of those teams next year. All the teams that changed coaches, none of them are on our schedule. And what that tells you, you know, generally, if you're changing coaches, your season, your previous season didn't go very well. It's not always the case, but generally. So those are some of the weaker teams in the league, at least on paper right now, and the Bucks aren't playing any of them. On paper, the Bucks have the most difficult schedule in the league in 2018.
In the entire league.
Yeah, and that's not really all that surprising, given that all three of the other teams in our division made the playoffs. So they all won
just
10 or
alone.
More games.
Yep.
So you have six games against teams that won 10 or more games. That pushes it right over the top. And then we play the NFC East. So you got teams like Philadelphia.
Yep.
And then we play the AFC North. So you've got Pittsburgh and Baltimore and Cincinnati.
We just keep having to play teams that were in the Super Bowl the year before.
Yep.
We had both the Patriots and the Falcons last year. And then now we've got the Eagles again. It's just like, man.
And we came very close to beating both of those teams last year, but
didn't. That's very
true. Yeah.
It is worth noting, though, that what people always predict as the difficulty of a schedule never ends up panning out exactly how they would have thought it would pan out in terms of strength of schedule predictions before the season. And then, I mean, nobody thought that the Rams or the Vikings were going to do what they did this year. There's always exceptions.
There's going to be some twists, but if you look at our division, who do you see declining? You know, those teams all should be pretty strong next year. So
that's
the Bucks are going to have to take a big step forward.
Yep, that's very true. Then again, the
other coaching change, that one that hasn't quite happened yet in Indianapolis, is interesting from an industry standpoint because, you know, we've worked for teams for quite some time, and you always struggle with when you're allowed to release news, right? And now you get a very clear example of why
we don't always release things right away.
Often don't like to say anything until the pen is on the paper.
That's very true.
And it can be frustrating, but it's easy to see why in situations.
Why that's
such
a good idea.
This.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, we're going to move into some of our Twitter questions now. We had John ask us, I heard that Aaron Donald said he watches Gerald McCoy's film. Does this help explain how good Gerald is and maybe even why Aaron Donald has done so well?
Well, I think Aaron Donald has done so well because he's an incredibly talented player. I'm sure Gerald would say the same thing. But that does, Gerald was in the league maybe 4 years before Aaron, so it makes sense. What it shows you is that around the league, young players consider him like one of the gold standards at the position, as well they should. And if Aaron Donald gets to know Gerald McCoy at all, they probably know each other. He will find out what a hard worker he is, too. But I imagine Aaron Donald is also a very hard worker, and he's just an extremely talented player. I actually would have picked him for Defensive Player of the Year this year.
Mm.
Did he get it? I can't remember.
Oh, Aaron Donald, yes, he did.
He did get it. Okay, well, then, wow, I really went out on a limb on that one, didn't I?
Yeah, the Rams basically swept the whole awards, defensive, offensive coach of the year, all that kind of thing, which is crazy. They just missed out on an MVP. Okay, our next question is from Kevin. He says, I know the record wasn't what we hoped it would be, but it seems like people are saying the Bucks were worse than they actually were, and forget that they only lost a few games by some missed kicks and injuries. So yeah. I think he's saying the record versus the actual team versus what people remember about the team.
The stat that goes with this is called the Pythagorean theorem. You ever heard?
Yes,
I mean, you know what the Pythagorean theorem
is. Yeah, I don't know how it applies here, so please
I don't remember
me.
how this analysis got titled that, and then a writer named Bill Barnwell uses this a lot. It's the same thing in baseball. I think I discussed this the other day. When you have a team that has a lot of one-run losses, it has a bad record in one-run games, mm-hmm. a lot of that comes down to just anything can happen at the end of the game, and it's kind of fluky. Well, the Buccaneers were 3-7 in games decided by a score or less, and 1-4, I think, in games decided by 3 points or less. And yes, there were missed kicks involved in some of those. You know, the Carolina game, basically a fourth down conversion by an inch made the difference in that one. So yes, when you look at a team that was in a lot of close games and their record didn't go well in those games, they're a good choice for a team that can break out the next year.
Hmm.
And the difference between how a team performs, expected to perform in such games, and how they actually did perform plays into the whole Pythagorean theorem. So they'll say, this team, you would have expected them to win, you know, we won five games, you would have expected us to win seven or eight. So in reality, no, the season did not go actually better than it looks like. It didn't go better because
the reality is you
win 5-11.
Yep.
You didn't get the job done in those close games. But if you're looking for reasons for hope for the next season, that's more like what that is. So
that's a good
nobody
point.
Here is going to try to claim, hey, we were really not a 5-11 team.
Right, because you're 5-11.
You got to fix the reasons that kept you from getting over the hump in all those games. And one of those, yes, was a kicker issue.
Okay.
At least early on.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, Eric says, when you look at this team, do you see a team ready to play more of a 4-3 front or a 3-4 front? And should Beckwith kick inside with how much success he had there? And then he says, in a 3-4, don't replace Kwan.
So he's specifying that. If you have a whole lot of talent at linebacker, do you find ways to get them all mm-hmm. on the field? And I don't think that the Bucks are going to stray from being a 4-3 base defense, because that's what Mike Smith is.
Right.
But you, as you saw already, and as we discussed many times during the season, depending on the type of fronts over and under and various different packages you're in, every team gives 3-4 and 4-3 looks throughout the year. And Kendall, you saw that with Kendall Beckwith, a stand-up pass rusher, with three down linemen several times. We had four linebackers on the field at times. We had three linebackers and an extra defensive back. That's actually the more common thing that we did, three linebackers. Generally, you take your strong side linebacker off when you bring in an extra DB. But in this case, we were trying to keep our best defenders on the field. So I think you'll probably see more multiple looks. He's right. You can't really replace Kwan, so you can't say Kendall looked great in the middle,
right?
But I think he's versatile enough to kind of play everywhere, and to go strictly to a 3-4 so that you always have two inside linebackers on the field would be a pretty massive change. It would also involve changing some personnel, and it's, you know, the Buccaneers already are in a deficiency with pass rushers, and now if you're changing the type of player you see as a pass rusher, now you're probably even farther away from your goals. So switching to a 3-4 is probably not in the cards for the Buccaneers.
Okay. And then our last question here, we had Simba ask, how would you say the Alley project worked out for us? I love it. It sounds like the Manhattan Project or some like super secret thing.
You know, I would say it's still a work in progress. It's still the project's not over yet. It's something that I'm sure they're reviewing and they're looking at, was it worthwhile to move him to center? I'd say the jury's out on that right now.
And that'll be something I'm sure we hear them asked about a lot.
Yeah, exactly, especially when you're talking about the draft and what sort of players could you, if you're trying to add to your offensive line, he gives you the flexibility. If there's a point where you think you can add a really good center, then maybe you think about moving Alley back to guard. If there's a point where you can add a really good guard, then the fact that you can leave him at center is a plus. So I think the fact that he's proven he can play both probably makes it easier for the Buccaneers to address their offensive line this offseason.
So it might be more about free agency and draft and what you find there than what Alley actually did.
That's what I would think.
Okay, that's interesting. All right, that's going to do it for us here on Buccaneers Insider Live presented by Miller Lite. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep sending those questions in throughout the week. Use that hashtag BucksLive, and we'll see you next time.